From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll listen to our Across the Red and Blue Divide discussion recorded last week. What does bipartisanship look like in a state divided almost exactly in half by ideology? We'll hear from a Republican.
The one thing that every elected official has to earn, no matter what their district is trust to their constituents.
And from a Democrat.
No matter what your makeup of your district is, you represent everybody there once you're elected. And so it's important to make sure everybody has a place at the table, everybody knows your door is open no matter what side of the aisle they're on.
Plus a conversation about the new film Boy Erased, and we'll learn how you can add volunteerism to the mix during your next vacation.
Lake Effect is next after the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Wisconsin voters went to the polls 2 weeks ago today and elected Democrats to all the statewide offices and the U.S. Senate, while leaving both houses of the legislature in Republican hands.
Voter turnout in Wisconsin and around the country was extremely high for a midterm election. Political analysts attribute that to controversy over President Trump's policies and the country's hyperpolarized and politicized state.
But now that the election itself is history, what are the opportunities for people to stay involved in the process? That was the central focus of our latest Across the Red and Blue Divide event. It was presented in partnership with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the Millennial Action Project, and the Zeidler Center for Public Discussion.
The panel discussion was held last week, and it features Journal Sentinel Capital Bureau reporter Molly Beck, plus the leaders of the Future Caucus, Republican Adam Nalin and Democrat Amanda Stuck. It's the only bipartisan caucus in the legislature.
The event was moderated by the Millennial Action Project founder and President Stephen Olakara and Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke.
So in the time right after the midterm election here in Wisconsin, the quote I kept hearing from people is that we are not so much a purple state as we are a bright red and bright blue state, where the bright red people live right next door to the bright blue people. And I wonder, the two of you each were reelected in unopposed races, I believe. So maybe some of the angst going into the election didn't quite exist for you. But I'm curious to hear, when we talk about building trust between our elected officials and the people who elect them, what do you see as the responsibility in a state that is 51-49 Democrats versus Republicans one election and maybe 51-49 Republicans over Democrats the next? What is the responsibility of the 51 to the 49? And likewise, what's the responsibility of the elected officials from the 49 to the 51?
Well, I think that's a really good question. So I think, first of all, no matter what your makeup of your district is, you represent everybody there once you're elected. And so it's important to make sure everybody has a place at the table, everybody knows your door is open no matter what side of the aisle they're on. So I think that it's really important that we do try and be intentional about holding events like this or things in our district where we really do invite anybody, no matter their political background, to talk to us and engage with us and truly listen and do our best to include their concerns in everything that we do and not just ignore them or push them out because we don't have to listen to them or because we don't agree with them.
Yeah, I think the one thing that every elected official has to earn, no matter what their district is trust of their constituents. And I think ultimately when you look at some of the makeup of some of the districts, such as mine is a very conservative district in Waukesha County, I don't always take the very conservative line on everything I do. And I think I'm able to have that leeway because ultimately my voters trust me to work in their best interest. And as legislators, sometimes we have to do the unpopular thing if we think it's right. Whether or not that's the 51 or the 49, or, you know, there's issues that I really care passionately about, like making sure we have safe regulations for self-driving cars in the future. My district's terrified of that. They don't want self-driving cars on their roads. But I think it's within our best interest to make sure we have safe regulations. So sometimes you have to go against the flow of what your district thinks you should be doing. And the only way you're able to do that is by gaining their trust in being visible, being part of the community, showing up to things, getting back to constituents, no matter what their opinions are. If they contact my office, I make sure to make an effort to reach out and get back to them. So I think it's about building trust, and then when you have that trust, doing what you think is in the best interest of the state moving forward.
Can you remember constructive times when someone who did not vote for you came into your office and offered you a suggestion that caused you maybe to stop in your tracks and say, hey, I never considered it that way?
Oh, all the time. All the time. I mean, I think it's important, first of all, as elected officials, to recognize that we're not right 100% of the time. Right. I think that is one issue every single person is right sometimes and wrong sometimes. And I think if you are going to be an effective leader in your community, you have to stop, take a deep breath, and be willing to adjust. One specific issue I can think of was in my first session, there was a piece of legislation that limited food stamps for people that to healthy choices, right? And there was a big controversy over what this meant in terms of what people would be able to purchase. And I voted for the bill the first session. I talked to a lot of constituents, some that were on food stamps, some that had family on food stamps. I dug into the issue, and I realized that this bill might not be in our best interest, and I voted against it the second time. And, you know, I think that ultimately I made the right decision, but you could say, you know, there is a fear from a lot of people that would be labeled as a flip-flopper or somebody that is going against what their core value is, opposed to trying to learn more about an issue and do the right thing. So I think there is a fear for some people that they're afraid to be wrong, so they dig in and they try to really make their case opposed to trying to do what's in the best interest. But yeah, I can think of examples.
Yeah. Well, and I think a good legislator does make sure that whenever an issue comes before them, that they do reach out to the people who may agree with the issue and hear what they have to say, and that they also reach out to people on the other side to understand their position. I think that's really the best legislators do that, and that good lobbyists, too, when they come to us, are ready to tell us both sides of the issue and who stands on what side, so we can understand all of the arguments and all of the different perspectives on any given issue.
So I want to ask a question of our legislators and get Molly in on this, because as you both know, I grew up in this Milwaukee area, and I've seen the politics of the greater Milwaukee area and of the state become increasingly polarized during the time that I've been following politics here. And that's why I'm very grateful for, of course, the work that you're doing. We've got a new session coming up starting in January 2019. A new set of people are coming in, and of course, we'll have a new governor. So I want to get your thoughts on where do you see some interesting bipartisan opportunities generally with the legislature and the governor, and particularly for you, what are some issues that you might want to work on in a bipartisan way? Maybe we'll start with Amanda.
Yeah, I think it will be really interesting, considering that it will be pretty divided, that the Republicans will have control of the legislature, but yet we have a Democratic governor. There's a potential for this to go several different ways. It could be that nothing gets done because the Republicans just pass things that the governor vetoes and nothing gets done. It could be that it does force us to work together. I think that would be the ideal, that now we really do have to work together. If anybody wants anything done at all, we have to have some compromise. And so I think ideally that that's where we will go. I think the Future Caucus may play a big role in that, because we already have some trust, some relationships built there. We've already had some talk about different legislation. To me, there's so many things I would love to work on, whether it's fair maps, whether it's student loans, whether it's just talking about how we keep young people here. I know that's something we've talked about in the Future Caucus in the past, doing things like rural tours to figure out how do we keep young people here, especially in rural areas. So I think there's, you know, anything is possible, but it's just a matter of do we have the will of the legislatures to really do that and bring ourselves together.
Yeah, if I... I just add that one thing I'm excited about with the future caucuses, I just want to point out that we are the only bipartisan caucus in the entire state legislature. And I think one of the benefits of doing something like this is to have a platform where we're able to discuss things in a productive manner. Because unfortunately, a lot of politics, once something gets to the floor, a lot of times it's all for show, right? I mean, we know how people are gonna vote, you know, and the debate and the discussion, it's important, but ultimately it's not swaying people one way or the other because the tallies have been counted, the votes have been whipped, and we know what the final tally is going to be. Here in this bipartisan caucus, here's an opportunity that we're going to be able to work across the aisle prior to this, so we're able to shape legislation, to form ideas, to work together, to try to build consensus on things. And I think one additional thing I'll add, I don't disagree with what Amanda said, but to add also education. I think almost everybody ran on increasing funding towards education. What that looks like, I think that's where going to be where the discussions are. Is that going to be per pupil? Is that going to be putting more money into things like robotics and computer science or computer programming opportunities? How are we going to spend this money? How much of the money is going to go into the classrooms? How much is going to go to extracurricular? So I think education is one that we're going to be able to build consensus on in terms of, okay, we're going to put additional funding in. Now we need to figure out what's it going to look like, where's it going to go, how much.
Yeah. And Molly, you've been following this election closer than anyone, and you've seen the different dynamics play out. And as you've reported, the governor-elect had talked a lot about the desire to build consensus, work across the aisle to try and unify the state. What do you think he'll be running into next year? Do you think he'll succeed at that? And what do you think, if the answer is no, what do you think he should be doing right now to be more successful?
I think he won't be as successful as he probably thinks he will be at this moment, you know, and they'll find their footing with each other. But it doesn't seem to me that the governor-elect or the legislature's leadership are people that don't want to see anything done. You know, that's just my interpretation of what I've seen, you know, for the past couple years. Is I think they'll want to see something get done. So I think you might see more bipartisanship than you might expect at this point. I could see the issue of transportation being one area. In the last session, that was a major roadblock to getting the budget done. But I think a big part of that was Governor Walker's, you know, position that he didn't want to sign anything that raised the gas tax. And so I think that put some lawmakers in a position of saying, well, why pass something that might do that, you know? So with that gone, that might be an area where they can see what they can do in that area, and also in education. Obviously, Governor-elect Tony Evers is from the education world, and that was his big campaign platform, is putting more money into education. And I haven't, as Adam said, I haven't heard anybody say they're not for that, you know? So that could be another area too.
Let me stay with you for a minute here, Molly. And we were talking kind of off to the side before about some of the close races that existed, like the 14th Assembly District, which I think was decided by just a couple of hundred votes. When you look at something like that, we hear a lot about these calls for bipartisanship. Do you see that as evidence of that, or do you see that as that there were 250 more people in the 14th Assembly District that wanted somebody to always vote with Democrats, or in a close race that went the other way, that there were, you know, a few more people that wanted, you know, Republicans to vote with a Republican majority most of the time?
I think what you saw is there was just much more enthusiasm on the Democratic side, and there might be some shifting demographics going on in those areas. Everybody I've talked to since the election has said that it was just there were more Democrats voting, you know, and I don't know if that means that there are, you know, if it was fatigue on the part of Republican voters, or if there's just different kinds of voters in those areas right now.
But it almost sounds like on the macro level, we hear a lot of people talking about how we want bipartisanship and people to work together, but when they elect their individual representatives, they vote for the person that they think is going to represent them most often, right?
Right, right. And I think in this election, you know, there were probably some voters who were voting for other reasons too, that were not
maybe people that weren't actually on the ballot.
I mean, to our two representatives, how do you square these two kind of phenomena going on?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would say a couple of things. First of all, the Future Caucus is one of the things I get asked most about, and one of the things in terms of the press that I've been asked most about and people want to talk about. So I think there is a real hunger and thirst to see legislators work together. Certainly, when you knock on doors, you hear it all the time, people saying, why can't you guys work together? Why can't you guys get stuff done? So I do think people want to see that. And, you know, I'd argue we both, I mean, you could also argue maps, but we also both had uncontested races, and I would say maybe part of that from anecdotally, obviously not scientifically, but anecdotally, people like to see legislators work together, and hopefully there is some reward for that for legislators that work together. They do get reelected, and people support that.
Yeah, I mean, people are complex, right? So anytime you try to like attribute it to one thing or one issue or it's never really that cut and dry. You know, I think everybody has their own reasons for doing things. And one thing I'm learning is so much of, like I mentioned earlier, so much of it is about trust and about personality. And I think people are willing to vote for somebody that they disagree with on certain issues, maybe not their core issues, but on certain issues, if they trust that that person has the best interest in that area in mind or their community for whatever reason. There are some people that they want you to fight, right? They want you to go into Madison and fight for what they believe in. But by and large, the large majority want to see people that get along. And that doesn't necessarily mean anything about the actual policy of what you're getting along on, but it's the style of being agreeable, being willing to have an open door, being nice, being somebody that is willing to pick up the phone and call you back, someone that's willing to go knock on your door and introduce themselves. You know, so I think that there's a lot of complex issues and that it's hard to boil it down into one reason or another. But ultimately, I think it's about personality. It's about that trust, and it's about what that person represents to that community more so than the politics of exactly every single policy of what that person believes in.
That's Republican Adam Nalin, who represents Wisconsin's 98th Assembly District. We'll be back with more of our Across the Red and Blue Divide special when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. We return now to our Across the Red and Blue Divide event, which was recorded last week at Best Place at the historic Pabst Brewery. It features three guests, Republican Assemblyman Adam Nalin and Democrat Amanda Stuck, along with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Capitol Bureau reporter Molly Beck.
It's moderated by Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke and by Stephen Olakara, a Brookfield native who's the founder and president of the Millennial Action Project.
Is there anything that the governor-elect could do now or in the next few months that to kind of build his trust with the Republican-led legislature on, there are a few issues that we've mentioned here where there is obvious common ground, but as you were mentioning, you have to have that initial trust to start having the conversation so these ideas can be co-created together.
Right.
Is there anything that he should be doing now to build that trust with Republican legislators and with Republican voters around the state?
I would say that first and foremost, I think when someone's new to a situation, any situation, it helps to put yourself out there just as a person first. So having meetings, picking up the phone, calling people, and getting to know people. I know that's kind of a boring and dry thing in terms of not giving a lot of, oh, well, he can do this, this, and this. But in terms of getting to know people, it's amazing how much of politics is just about personalities. It's about getting along. It's about being able to have trust in terms of, okay, I want to get to this place. How can we get there? And I think that there are certain issues that we can agree on, and maybe starting at a place where we can agree on, opposed to starting at a place where we know we're all gonna dig our heels in and be like, no, I don't think that you should do this. So maybe starting with finding common ground, you know, but at the same time, you know, strategists might tell you, no, you're the most political capital you have is right away, right? So do what you think you're able to do right away to try to get that done. So I think that my answer would be, instead of trying to find the specific issues that might wedge us, might drive a wedge between us, to spending time getting to know personalities, getting to know actual people behind the office. And I think once you establish those relationships, I think you're able to get a lot more constructive things done because you have formed that level of trust.
The title of tonight's forum is actually, You Voted, Now What? You're looking at a room full of people. Can I get a show of hands? How many people in this room voted? Yeah, so, first of all, outstanding. Secondly, this is just the group to be here for this event. What would you have them do? They have sent people to office. How much of what you would like to see from them is patience to see how things play out? And when it comes to holding their elected officials' feet to the fire, how would you have them do that?
So I would say, you know, stay involved. Certainly you can't just vote and then not pay attention to what the people that you voted for do for the next 2 or 4 years. You know, I know when I've held town halls, I've had nobody show up at all in my community. So show up, even if you think they're on your side and are doing what you want, show up to show support for that or to check in and make sure they really are doing what you wanted them to do. You know, keep in touch with ideas on things you want them working on. Don't be afraid to write and call. Just really stay in touch and keep track of what they're really doing instead of just thinking now that you voted, you don't ever have to pay attention to what they're doing again.
Yeah, I think that's good. It's a little bit hard to tell such a activated, motivated group what to do because this is probably one of the answers I would say is come to something like this. So you're already here. Congratulations. But I would say that since I'm talking to such a active, motivated group, I would say that the number one issue is put yourself in someone else's shoes that you disagree with. Try to understand where they're coming from. All of us are shaped by external factors that a lot of us have no control over, right? So your politics is shaped by your experience. Like, and who wants to live in a world that everyone disagrees, right? So I think that instead of thinking, that person's an idiot. You know, that person is just stupid. Or that person is a bad person. Or for whatever, you know, whatever thoughts that, you know, we all have when we hear somebody that we think is completely wrong, put yourself in their shoes. Try to understand their experience. Try to understand their background, what they've been through. And don't just judge their politics or who they are based on your own experience within life. Try to understand where they're coming from. And I think if we can all be more sympathetic and compassionate to where people come from and how they have shaped their worldview, then I think it will lead to more productive discussions and less arguments.
Not with gerrymandering.
Yeah, well, what do you think about that?
In terms of gerrymandering?
Yeah, we are outvoted.
So I don't want to get in a political debate.
We're not outvoted in the
So let me say this. If you take away the city of Milwaukee and the city of Madison from the vote, you have almost 60% of the vote that went to Republicans, right? So if each district by district, you have a large number of Republicans that voted for their person. I mean, if you have Milwaukee and Madison, everybody that represents the city of Milwaukee is a Democrat. You don't have a gerrymandered situation where there's a Republican representing downtown Milwaukee. You don't have a situation where there's a Republican representing downtown Madison. We have a unique situation here in Wisconsin where a lot of people, they cluster into areas. Like if you're somebody that is wants to live in Milwaukee or Madison, you're gonna be represented by a Democrat. I mean, I don't know, I don't believe that gerrymandering has led to the 63 majority. It's not because of gerrymandering. It's just not. I mean, you have, and now you have a situation where the statewide was to Tony Evers, and you have a situation where now you are represented, Democrats are represented in the process of mapping now, right? So there is going to be more fairness within, but the last maps that were drawn, statewide, it was Governor Walker, it was the Senate was Republican, the Assembly was Republican, so you have a situation where there was nothing done illegally that...
Let me jump in for a second here, and talking to our two members of the future caucus, what happens when the issue of drawing the maps comes up in a room with Republicans and Democrats, and you know, you both have something to win or lose from how these next maps are drawn? How do you talk about that issue, or is it, you know, what happens in future caucus stays in future caucus?
Well, we haven't necessarily talked about this in future caucus directly, but within the Democratic caucus, I mean, I would say we have put out the nonpartisan redistricting bill over and over and over and haven't been able to get a hearing on it. And that's really what we have talked about is nonpartisan. I mean, certainly we have one or two Democrats that would like to think in some magical world we'll get the majority and can draw the maps in favor of us, and that would be fine with them. But the majority of us know that's just not the way it should be. It should be nonpartisan. It really should not be in the hands of the legislators, because it's just not fair.
So when you look at common ground on an issue like redistricting, and I'd be curious to have Molly weigh in on this also, what is the one thing that you want to assure Wisconsinites of when new maps are drawn?
I think the feedback that I get from people when this issue comes up is that they feel, at least right now in this moment, that they feel that their boundaries are rigged if they are not in favor of the maps. But people who don't think that way do not feel like Republicans are going to be in power forever in some of these districts. You know, so it's a difficult issue to discuss because on both sides they're just. You know, there's nothing that's really going to sway either side.
I mean, there's not a constitutional right to a competitive district, is there? So what's the
constitutional right? I would say there's probably a moral obligation that you should have a fair election that should be competitive.
So when you start talking about this, what's the common ground that you start from when you start unpacking this? We want to assure that all the voters in Wisconsin have X.
Well, I'm not sure how you're going to take a situation where you have a ton of voters that are packed into Milwaukee and Madison and then specifically draw it so to make sure that people in Waukesha County have a competitive seat. I mean, Waukesha County is by and large a conservative area. So it's very difficult then to take a map, unless you're doing it the other way, right? In putting it, saying, okay, I'm specifically attempting to make this a more Democrat area. And I think that, you know, if we want to, I think that now with a Democrat governor, I think there will be some area consensus where we can go back and look at this process. But I don't think that the map that we have right now is gerrymandered to the point that we only won because of the map. That's just not true. And people that think that, I think their view is skewed based on their perception of what they think is fair.
So Adam's bringing up the point of process, and that I think is a good answer to your question, Mitch, is I think there are a lot of different ways to slice up the districts. You can pack people in, you can mix folks up, and there are a lot of different arguments about the types of representatives you know, do you want someone who represents just a city area, or do you want someone who can represent a city and a suburban area? And there are different arguments around that. But to Mitch's point, I think, and to Adam's point as well, I think at the end of the day, voters need to feel like the process was fair. The way that it was deliberated was fair, and that there was some level of consensus across the aisle.
Well, and to some degree, what you were saying, Adam, just a couple minutes ago, that people's attitudes are shaped by their experience, and so there are a lot of people on both sides of the aisle whose experience is that they hold some pretty deeply held political beliefs, but they live in a place where they feel like they're outvoted every step of the way. And so what's and honestly, what's the answer to that? I don't know.
Well, and then those people, a lot of times, then they stop voting because they feel like, what's the point? And that's really unfortunate that that drives people to stop participating in the process. But I think that's why fair maps are so important, so that people do feel like their vote matters, like it does matter if they show up. And so the best we can, I mean, certainly there's probably no perfect process, to Adam's point, but to the best we can, you know, we should be trying to have fair elections all the way around. So it really is about the voters choosing and having a fair process.
Amanda Stuck is a Democrat who represents Wisconsin's 57th Assembly District. Adam Nalen is a Republican who represents District 98 in the Wisconsin State Assembly. And Molly Beck covers the state capitol for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
They were speaking as part of our Across the Red and Blue Divide event, which was recorded last week. It was called You Voted, Now What? Parts of our broadcast were edited.
We'll take a short break and return with a conversation about the film Boy Erased. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. The film Boy Erased tells the true story of the son of a Baptist preacher who is sent to a church-supported gay conversion program after being outed to his parents during his freshman year of college.
Only 13 states and Washington, D.C. have banned the practice of conversion therapy, and Wisconsin is not among them. Earlier this year, the Milwaukee Common Council approved a ban of the practice, and momentum behind similar legislation is growing in cities throughout the state.
Film contributor Ryan Jay joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio to talk about the film and the therapy. They were later joined by Boy Erased director and actor Joel Edgerton by phone. First, Jay starts with his initial impressions of the film.
In hearing you talk about it now, and certainly the emotional response that I had in viewing this movie, which was horror, anger, furious reaction. I wanted to throw my shoe at the screen many times, but I really equate these boot camps, as you call them, to, in a dramatic way, the Holocaust, in the sense that, like, the Holocaust is over. We all know about it. We read about it like history. We watch movies about it. We cry. We remember. And we're horrified at these crimes against humanity, and we think that happened, and it can't ever happen again. You see a movie like Boy Erased, and sure, maybe you're not murdering people, but the emotional and physical damage, psychological damage that is happening to these children is not happening in the past. It's happening right now. And that's what really freaked me out while watching this movie, that it's a true story, that it happened to the character that's a real man based on his novel, and that it's actually happening to other people in the LGBTQ community right now in this country. And that is a great part of the reason why the majority of teenage suicides in America are, the majority, once again, majority are LGBTQ people.
And this film, you know, with any hard, heavy topic, a director, the filmmaker's producer, have to have a certain degree of sensitivity to perhaps not alienate people, but also keep the balance to show the serious degree of this matter. And as you mentioned, this is based on Jared Conley's memoir of the same name, of his experience as a teen in Arkansas. But with this film, obviously the focus is the character played by Lucas Hedges. But I felt like I understand the need to stay balanced, but this film also left me wanting for a little more depth, especially in the additional characters featured. What did you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I would have loved to have seen some more backstory to the other people that were in this camp with Gerard Conley. But I also appreciated the way that we really got such insight into him and his relationship with his mom and dad. And what we're witnessing here are Oscar-worthy performances. There will be nominations for this film in several categories. Lucas Hedges is amazing. I certainly identified with him in certain ways. But I also saw my own mother in Nicole Kidman's performance, something I never imagined. Nicole Kidman's my favorite actress, and I never thought I'd see my mother in Nicole Kidman, you know, but she has her hairstyle, she has her nails, she wears her jewelry, she wears her outfits. I was like looking at my mom, of course, in Nicole Kidman's statuesque figure, which, you know, don't we all wish we had that figure, right? So, but also in personality. The personality of this mother is very much how I've seen my mom behave in different points in her life. So I identified in many ways, and I was glad to have, you know, how long can a movie be? I was glad to have in about, you know, 90 minutes, an hour and 45 minutes, have a film where it could really see this mother and son relationship, see the complications with this father brilliantly portrayed by Russell Crowe. He's the right casting choice. And then, yeah, it would have been great to explore some more, but maybe this will inspire other stories like this to come to the big screen.
Right. As you mentioned, Russell Crowe also portrays the father, and he's a Baptist preacher down south, also owns a dealership that he intended to pass along to his son, and, you know, all of his expectations for his son's future suddenly change. But I went away with perhaps his role maybe was not as aggressive or ominous as we would have suspected for the father being a preacher. It was simply a matter of, you know, his son also agreed to go to this camp. And people do agree to undergo these so-called, quote, treatments.
Well, when you think back to your coming out process, he wasn't a fully integrated person. He wasn't self-actualized at the time. He was still struggling with his sexuality and his identity. And that's a thing that many of us go through. You know, when we first accept or have the revelation that we are part of the LGBTQ community, there's denial at play, there's fear. And so you may be, especially in an extremely religious situation, wanting to make your parents proud and please them. Give it a shot. You don't know if you, depending on how sheltered your life is. We now know that you cannot change a person. I mean, you can barely in a relationship change your husband or wife to want to go to the same movie that you want to go to,
yeah,
let alone think you're going to change someone's sexuality. You can't change people. But there are, a section of people who believe it is something that is a choice. And interestingly, we recently had an opportunity to talk to writer, director, and co-star Joel Edgerton about that very topic.
Yeah, so let's head on back to that. He joined us by phone amidst a tour of various TV and radio stations.
All right, Joel Edgerton, thank you so much for joining us. You know, in Boy Erased, the role of the mother, it doesn't get any better than Nicole Kidman. She gives an award-worthy performance. What was it like directing her and also sharing scenes with her?
Horrible person, Nicole. look, it's a real dream. I guess there's an intimidation to turning up to work with somebody that not only is you well aware of their work for so long and they're such a master, but also, as an Australian actor, she is somebody that I had identified with wanting to, you know, break into working over in Hollywood myself. But, you know, look, she's so graceful. She really kind of melds with her characters really beautifully. And you know, when you know Nicole, she's only going to turn up to do a movie with anybody if she really identifies with the subject. So I felt like it was a real blessing to me, and I feel very privileged to be making a movie with her and Russell. In fact, you know, my entire wonderful cast.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and with Nicole, her character kind of represents the changing mindset. And with this movie, you know, how did you want to appeal to all audiences? Because the true challenge would be getting people who perhaps believe that being gay is a choice and the central argument of this film. So do you think this film could potentially change minds and hearts of people enough to make a difference?
Yeah, and I think Nicole's character actually is the great sort of linchpin in that regard. In that I'm fascinated by, you know, I tried not to judge anybody in particular in this movie. I think that we're all human. We make choices based on the information and education that we have and the belief system we have. And what if you find out that that is leading you to cause somebody damage when you otherwise thought you were trying to help or do something out of love? That's what Nicole's character stands for. Garrett's mother was complicit in allowing him to go to conversion therapy, realized it was causing him hurt and damage and pain, and she re-examined that choice, and now she's done a complete 180. And I think that she is a great hero, a great example of a regular suburban hero, and worth watching the movie just to identify with that, because it's okay to make mistakes. What I'm curious about is what a person does next in order to examine and rectify that.
Mm-hmm. It's really incredible. Now, what inspired you to take on this project? I imagine you knew of the book, but at any point during the filmmaking process, did you imagine that a gay director might have handled it differently?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder. I think any director would have handled it differently. Many better than me and many worse than me, I'm not sure, but I actually was reticent to make the film as you know, not identifying as a member of the LGBTQ community. What I did know when I read the book was there was such a hopeful aspect to the film, the story, that someone needed to make the movie. And as a producer, I started researching and doing all that stuff. And when there was no one else really knocking down Garrett's door, I just started creatively getting involved by writing the screenplay. And then it just snowballed, and I realized that maybe, just maybe, you know, one of my qualifications was just how passionately obsessed with his story I was. But I had him as a partner, and I had his respect, and I had his seal of approval every step of the way, and shared him in the process. So, you know, I will always be curious to know how any different director handles a project, but I'm proud that I've been involved. I'm proud of what it's become and what it stands to do. So, yeah.
Well, you did absolutely brilliant work.
Thank you.
And on top of, as you mentioned, producing, writing the script, directing, you also play the character of Victor Sykes, the program director. So was this a matter of wanting to be fully integrated in taking on the role? And what kind of, you know, issues and depths did you want to bring to that, being both in front of and behind the camera?
Definitely directing and acting at the same time creates more of a challenge. But there was something fascinating. I'm always drawn to very complicated male characters who... It's something that, you know, wanting to not judge these people. Because when I met the real man, John Schmidt, he's a complicated man. I don't think he was trying to hurt anybody. But inadvertently, what he was involved in and the therapies he was pushing did cause damage. But I found him a very compelling sort of prospect as a character to play. And, yeah, so I gave myself a job, basically.
So brilliant. Joel, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Great work.
So that was writer, director, producer, actor, star Joel Edgerton of the film Boy Erased. So he touched upon some of the things that, you know, perhaps other directors would have done this differently, but he's proud of what happened overall. And what struck out to me with the script, there's also a power of silence, of cinematography, and also engaging viewers with a relatively stagnant visual setting. You know, you're in and out of this camp, you know, it's gymnasiums, neutral colors, all the, even the characters are wearing, you know, khakis and white shirts, can't go outside of that. So did you think that was dealt with appropriately, you know, to have such a heavy topic and yet still engage viewers in those ways that, you know, action movies over rely on, you know, the visual stimulation?
Well, I think that's part of the strength of this movie, because in addition to it being an important movie, you know, we're talking about some pretty big, horrifying topics here that are destroying people's lives, but it's still an incredibly entertaining movie. And I think that's in due in great part to the creative vision of director, and wearing that hat, director and star and writer, Joel Edgerton. He's telling a story not only through his screenplay and these great performances that he's eliciting through his co-stars and his cast, but also through the visuals, in their storytelling, in the score, in the soundtrack, and also in the costumes and in the desaturated colors, but that I think are also a natural part of this experience. God forbid there's any pink or blue.
Right. Now, do you think that this film was perhaps a little too sensitive about its subjects? You know, it's had mixed reviews from also just gay media outlets that although the film handles it well with sensitivity and is an ethical strength, do you think that, you know, it could have gone further, but would have that risked alienating audiences further? Because that is the goal here, is to get a wide variety of audiences to see.
Right. And I'm sure, and what we saw was horrifying, but I'm sure what actually happens is much worse than what's just depicted in this film. I'm sure there's things that, like, you know, you hear about the people that die on rides at Disney World. Actually, you don't hear about it because of that very reason, that we probably don't hear about people dying, perhaps, in these sort of boot camps. I'd love to see a Netflix documentary series about this. I'd love to see an anthology series dealing with young people and hardships and that are placed upon them, you know, in one season dealing with this situation. There's a lot more to explore here. This certainly is the tip of the iceberg, but I feel like if this movie doesn't inspire you to have, you know, regardless of what your personal beliefs are or where your faith lies or who you know in your community, you can't walk away from this movie and not want to talk about it with someone, whether it's someone that you know, with friends or family. It does raise questions because you, if you have any compassion, if there's an ounce of humanity or any love in your heart, you can't help but want to talk about this. It would be like walking out of, a Holocaust movie and not wanting to process it.
Right. And that is the good power of film, is not to just create sympathy, but empathy, which is a big difference. If you're visually seeing some of these, you know, based on true experiences that this author had, you know, there's a big importance and significance of film like this, you know. And we had the unique experience of this past year not having one but two movies about gay conversion therapy. We had The Miseducation of Cameron Post earlier this year. So who knows what happens with studios that it happens to be out like in the same year. But the fact that this is a topic of conversation, what is the greater significance that can hopefully continue the dialogue?
Absolutely. And until it's banned everywhere, because there is no, first of all, you can't change people, but second of all, it's actually harming people. This is a conversation worth having.
What would you say to people who are on the fence about seeing this?
Well, again, I think it comes back to the fact that it's an important film, but above and beyond that, it's entertaining as heck. It's a very good story that is told brilliantly without some of the year's best performances, and it will make you feel. One way or another, you will feel something, and who doesn't go to the cinema for that?
Well, Ryan Jay, thank you for joining me today, and I look forward to our next film.
Me too, thanks.
Film critic Ryan Jay is a resident reviewer for TMJ4. Joel Edgerton is the director, producer, writer, and one of the actors in Boy Erased. They spoke with Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find more of her conversations at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break and then talk about combining two things that many people love, vacation and volunteerism. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. A lot of us will have some time off later this week for Thanksgiving. It's a bit too short for most of us to consider it a vacation, but with the December holidays just around the corner, many of us are preparing for a lot more time off work.
An increasing number of people are combining their vacation time with their desire to do good works, and they're volunteering at least some of the time that they're away. It's something that Andrea Kahn has noticed. She's chief travel officer for the website The Family Backpack, and she joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in the studio recently to talk about the phenomenon of the volunteering vacation.
I think this is just starting to get some more attention because there's the extreme where your entire vacation can be a volunteer, but there's a lot of companies that now have come up with shorter-term stints. So you're not tied into, again, your entire week of vacation is volunteering, but it gives you a chance to maybe spend 4 hours of your vacation volunteering instead.
Well, and what do you think? I mean, aside from the good of doing something in the place that you've gone, how do you see a country differently or a city or a destination differently by volunteering there versus, you know, just doing the tourist things?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think one of the biggest things is you get a chance to meet local people that live there and interact with them and really get to know them and the culture a lot better, because you're going to have more meaningful conversations than, you know, just, you know, walking by a building, looking up and you're on your way. So it really allows you to form those connections. And those are people you might even connect with on Facebook or something else and form, you know, long-term friendships with.
Can you talk about what some of the companies are and what the kinds of things that people do on these vacations are?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a few of them. So one of them is actually Shore Trips, which is a local Milwaukee-based company.
Full disclosure, this is a company that you do some work for.
Yep, exactly. Full disclosure. So they actually have a Shore Trips Gives program, and it allows you to do just 4 hours in a port or a destination throughout the Caribbean and volunteer. And that can be working with children to volunteering at an animal shelter and helping with animals. So again, it gives you the opportunity to do shorter term volunteer, just 4 hours. Then there's other programs that gear especially towards families, which that's another thing, as some volunteer opportunities are better for adults. But there's one called International Volunteer. And this program, you can do anything from 1 week. You could do 24 weeks if you want to.
That'd be a nice vacation.
Exactly. You do homestays along the way. And a lot of their destinations are more Central and South America. Then there's the Solmar Foundation, which is in Los Cabos. That's another one where you can do a shorter stint volunteering at an orphanage or a nursing home, a shelter. There's the Sierra Club outings, which are family service on a farm. They are in places like Pennsylvania, and you actually are a farmhand, so it could be helping with baby goats to all the other chores. And then there's another one called Give a Day Global. They do stuff all over. One example that we found with one of our influencers was actually in Cancun, which gives you an opportunity to see Cancun in a completely different way and give back while you're there, you know, feel like you're connected to this community in a different way. And it's really a win-win. It makes you feel good. It does better for the community and the world we live in. Also, I think gives a better message for Americans if it is something abroad, you know.
Well, and I imagine that one could arrange a volunteer experience on their own, but this actually really takes a lot of the guesswork and a lot of the legwork out of it.
Exactly. These are reputable companies that, you know, make the whole thing a lot easier for you, so you're not guessing and you're not nervous about the experience that you're about to embark on.
Well, would you imagine, though, that to really take advantage of an experience like this, some proficiency in whatever the local language is important?
Yes, absolutely. I think so. I don't think it's a necessary. I know in some of these places it's not a necessary, but I do think it's helpful. I think it also gives you the chance to have some more meaningful, in-depth conversations with people if you know something beyond a few words in Spanish.
And as you say, it really gives you an opportunity to see a place in a much different light than just doing the sights on the tourist trip.
It does. It does. So, yeah. So I think within all these companies, again, there's that nice range of balance. If you're looking to devote an entire week to volunteer, or if you're simply looking to give back for a few hours on a vacation, because, you know, it's really easy to write the check. It's not so easy to give of our time. It's a challenge. We're all extremely busy, and it's a challenge in our own home cities, let alone when you go away. But having that chance to be able to carve out a little bit of a time is really a great experience.
It sounds like it. Is this something that you have done?
We've done a few things. When we've traveled to different parts of the world, we've actually packed suitcases full of extra supplies and given those as well. I am in the process of helping to organize a big family reunion in Wisconsin this summer. And we are actually, one of my cousins is helping out and looking for volunteer opportunities for our whole family to do during our week-long family reunion, because it's a great opportunity for all of us to bond together as a family, too, in a much different way.
What a great idea.
Yeah.
Andrea Kahn, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Andrea Kahn is the chief travel officer for the website The Family Backpack. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich about volunteering on vacation. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.